From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a legal showdown in North Carolina over voting rights. Plaintiffs in the case argue that the state's Republican legislature in 2013 passed rules that make it more difficult for minorities to vote. The state argues that the new laws are designed to protect an honest vote. It's all exploded since the Supreme Court took on the Voting Rights Act. This hour on Point, race, rights, and voting in North Carolina, and where we are as a nation on voting rights. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you following this case? Who is really pushing for what here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at the clash in Columbia, South Carolina, over the weekend between the KKK and black activists. Joining me first on the vote and voting rights in North Carolina from Winston-Salem is Paul Garber, reporter at the NPR affiliate WFDD. Paul's been closely covering the trial and testimony that began last week. Paul Garber, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Who has brought what case in this trial, and who's hearing it?
So the NAACP, the League of Women Voters, as well as some just regular voters out there, are the main plaintiffs in the case, and they are opposed to sweeping changes that the State General Assembly made in 2013. Basically, what happened was we had a wave election in 2010 that put the Republicans in control of the General Assembly after being out of power for more than 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
In the decade before that, the Democrats had made gradual changes to the election laws that made it easier for folks to vote. The Republicans came in 2010. This bill started as a fairly straightforward photo ID bill in 2013. Then the Voting Rights Act decision, the so-called Shelby decision, came out while it was still making its way through the General Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And once that decision came out, this bill greatly expanded, became more of an omnibus type elections law bill that included a lot more than photo ID. In fact, the photo ID is no longer even part of what is being argued about here in court today.
Now, the Supreme Court case that came in the middle of that process, as you say, Shelby County versus Holder, and the court in their decision said that a very important part of the Voting Rights Act would no longer hold. States covered by the Voting Rights Act, many of them in the South, had needed pre-clearance, federal approval before significant changes in their voting law. The court said, no, we've come far enough. That's no longer necessary. When that Supreme Court ruling came down, Did the complexion of the legislation that ultimately came out of the North Carolina legislature, did it change?
Yes, it did. It included a lot more things than just the photo ID that it first started out to be. It started including things like narrowing the time of early voting. So it cut out the first week of early voting. Early voting went from 17 days to 10. It got rid of out-of-precinct voting, and it got rid of pre-registration, which allowed teens as young as 16 to register to vote, although, of course, they wouldn't be eligible to vote until they were 18. The fact is they could register, and a lot of folks felt like that was a way of encouraging the young vote.
And that was seen as a bad thing?
Yes. The Republicans felt that there was concern about the integrity of the vote with all these changes, and that they needed to rein in what was happening in the election laws to give people confidence in that their vote that the votes were accurate and there wasn't fraud going on.
So limiting the days for early voting from 17 to 10, barring voters who turned up in the wrong precinct, same-day registration, is it under this law that's done away with?
Yes, it is.
And is that's a separate issue from what rallying young, soon-to-be voters before their voting age or registering
Correct.
Them?
Correct, yes. Mm. Right. So in North Carolina, was just one of a few states that allowed you to register when you were 16. And the idea was now you're in the process. When you go to vote when you're 18, you don't have to go through the burden of registration. You're already there. And that would help get that youth vote out.
What's the process now? Who's hearing this case and how does it get decided?
So this is a bench trial. It's being heard by Thomas Schroeder. He is a George W. Bush appointee in the federal court. Interestingly, he has already had a chance to rule once on this, on what the plaintiffs are arguing. Last year, he voted against an injunction that would have kept things from starting in the 2014 election. That was eventually overturned by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So he has already kind of considered this action once, felt like the plaintiffs didn't prove their point well enough to stop this from going into effect, and then has also been somewhat rebuked for his ruling in that law. And so that's going to be something that I'm sure will be on his mind during this trial.
That was overruled by the Fourth Circuit, but the voting went ahead in 2014.
Yes, it did. And yes, that's correct.
So the Department of Justice is involved here as well. How so?
Yes. So they are essentially on the plaintiff's side. They are concerned about the changes that the state legislature has made, particularly in terms of its effect on the minority voters and the youth vote.
What's the process here? Is this what the Supreme Court envisioned when they took pre-clearance out of the Voting Rights Act, that it would have to go to trial and then just be decided in a normal judiciary process?
Gosh, it's hard to speculate on that. You know, North Carolina wasn't completely under the Voting Rights Act. It had about 40 counties, I think, that were under it. And so those got, you know, removed when the Shelby decision came down, and that allowed for the statewide action that that is being debated now. And so that's kind of where we are. We'll see. You know, this is an important case because North Carolina isn't alone in getting this kind of challenge. There are other Republican states. There's kind of the common thread of Republican legislatures tightening up votes of decisions that were made to make voting earlier, you know, in the previous decade. That's the kind of common thread. A lot of states are going to be watching this decision because they're in litigation as well, and they want to see what happens.
You said the North Carolina legislature has put this in terms of vote integrity, wanting to keep an honest vote and wanting to tighten up to do that. What about those challenging this law? What's the argument that they're making?
Oh, there are all kinds of challenges. There is very little evidence of voter fraud per se here in North Carolina. The other challenge is, the question is, when they made these sweeping changes, did they cherry pick what they were going to change because they knew it disproportionately affected African American, Hispanics, and young voters? Because that's the case. That's what they're trying to argue, that if you look at, for example, who uses the first week of early voting the most? It's African Americans. That's their point. Who used pre-registration the most? The young, the folks who were 16 and 17 who weren't eligible but were getting enrolled anyway for when they would be eligible. Well, that was disproportionately African American as well. And so the question is, when they made these changes, was it about voter integrity, or was it about trying to keep people from voting that folks who passed these laws knew were more likely to vote for Democrats than they were for them?
There are plenty of states in the country that don't have what North Carolina used to have, don't necessarily have 17 days of voting before the vote, don't allow voting outside the precinct, don't necessarily have this pre-registration. Is that an argument that North Carolina doesn't need them either?
Yes, the voting the election laws across the country vary widely from state to state, as you mentioned, and they are certainly making the point that they're under no obligation to supply these things, and so they can decide whether or not they want to have them. Again, the question is, when they go to look at all these laws that they are changing, are they disproportionately affecting one group over another, and are they doing it on purpose? Now, I will point out that we have only heard the plaintiff's side at this point. The state will probably start their case later this week. So we haven't heard the main arguments, but you can certainly tell where they're going by the questioning and things like that.
Give us a sense of the plaintiff's testimony in that case. What's been heard in this first week of testimony? For example, voting out of precinct. Why would somebody do that?
Maybe because they moved and didn't know. We've heard from people who have been in that situation. We've had people who have moved, thought they could use same-day registration to vote at a new precinct and weren't able to. We've had people who moved and didn't know that they were then ineligible to vote in that other precinct, or they've been told, no, you're still registered in the old precinct, so there was confusion as where they should vote. And so that's kind of what the voter level reaction has been, that there's confusion when they get to the polls and what they can and can't do. And then, you know, and then they're left essentially without their vote counting.
There's a kind of proof in the pudding argument that's been made by supporters of these tightening revisions to the law, saying, look, in 2014, I think, African-American turnout at the polls was strong. And so, therefore, how can it be constricting voting if you've got strong turnout?
Yes, there was a double-digit increase among African-American voters compared to it was even larger. There was an increase in general in the 2014 election compared to 2010. There was a big increase, but that increase was larger among African-American voters than it was against white voters. And so that's been a key argument on the folks who are saying that we need these restrictions, that it didn't affect the turnout, as the plaintiffs say. Now, the counter-argument to that is North Carolina had a hugely important Senate race in 2014. A lot of folks thought that one way or another, that was going to sway the outcome of who would run the Senate. That was between Tom Tillis and Kay Hagan. The Republican eventually, Tom Tillis, prevailed in that election. You also have a majority-minority district, our District 12, that runs through the middle of the state, that is majority-minority. It has essentially been a safe district for Mel Watt since it was put together back in the early 90s. Suddenly, it became open, and so you had an open election, and the argument is that drew out voters as well. So you had a huge overall increase because of the interest in that Senate race, and then also among African Americans, they're arguing that that election also brought out an unusually large number of African Americans because they were deciding on that District 12 seat.
Our time is short, Paul. What are the odds that this could end up back before the Supreme Court for some fine-tuning?
Most people believe that's going to be the outcome.
Paul Garber with WFDD, NPR affiliate in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Wonderful to have you with us. Thank you very much for getting us started here, Paul.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about voting rights and North Carolina, a big case being heard there now on voting restrictions put in place after the U.S. Supreme Court softened the punch of the Voting Rights Act. Plaintiffs say the restrictions are racial in their intent. The legislature said this is about having an honest vote. There's been a lot of attention paid to this in North Carolina. Here's audio from an anti-voting law march held last Monday in Winston-Salem. Forward for voting rights there. But here's Mecklenburg County GOP Chair Curtis Watkins telling WSOC-TV last Monday that turnout in the 2014 election showed that the new voter rules did not limit access to the polls.
In the African American community, they turned out at a higher rate than they did in 2010, before the laws were enacted. So if it was really about suppression, you would expect to see the numbers drop.
Let's talk, get perspective from both sides of this case right now. With us from Los Angeles, Kareem Creighton, election law scholar and consultant until very recently, professor of law at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Kareem Creighton, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Alexandria, Virginia, J. Christian Adams, president, general counsel at the Public Interest Legal Foundation. They specialize in litigation to strengthen voter ID laws. He's a legal editor at PJ Media, conservative news and opinion website, served in the voting section of the U.S. Department of Justice from 2005 to 2010. He's author of the book Injustice, Exposing the Racial Agenda of the Obama Justice Department. J. Christian Adams, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Kareem Creighton, what's the argument here for bringing the Voting Rights Act on stage, holding it up against these measures and saying this should not stand?
Well, basically, the arguments, I think, were nicely laid out in the last segment. But I think the importance of this case need to be understood really in context, not just with what the legislature did here in rolling back a number of provisions meant to make opportunities more available to voters, but also what the Republican legislature did after 2010 when they took over the legislature for the first time. They crafted districts to make the political system tilted in their favor. And essentially, I think you can look at this latest round of substantive changes as meant to sort of secure their space. And the argument I think that the plaintiffs are making at this stage is, look, you can't argue that this is about the sort of substantive integrity of the political system when you have made all of these selective changes to the system that disfavor people you don't like because they don't vote for you in favor of the people that you do. And so thinking about how the Voting Rights Act post-Shelby County, the case that you all referenced in the last segment, can operate in this milieu, I think is exactly what this the plaintiffs are asking the court to do. The Supreme Court says we don't need any more administrative oversight as broadly defined as it has been, and now we put more pressure on litigation, and we're seeing the first instance of that play out.
J. Christian Adams, the argument that we've heard from only plaintiffs so far, the state will lay out its case. The plaintiffs are saying these measures that were legislated appear tailored to discourage minority voting. What do you say, sir?
Well, the problem the plaintiffs are going to have are the empirical facts. Those the facts are that minority voting has not suffered since these laws have gone into place. In fact, the data show that it's actually improved. And so you have an extremely difficult case, both factually and legally, in North Carolina for the plaintiffs. Not only do they have bad facts, they have a state that enacted this law, for example, getting rid of same-day registration, when you had instances like the town of Pembroke, North Carolina, that had a local election that had to be done over because of unverified voters participating in that election because of these same-day registration laws that are now at issue in the case that were repealed. You also have an extremely novel application of the Voting Rights Act, one that is simply without much support in the appellate courts. It's a novel idea that you can show small statistical differences and get a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. That's never been done before. It's a novel an untested and probably ultimately doomed theory that the plaintiffs are pursuing.
Doesn't it have to be a novel approach, J. Christian Adams, since the court has changed the earlier framework of how of preclearance and that kind of federal oversight? Isn't it almost novel by necessity?
No, it's totally unrelated. The Section 5 standards still in place. You can always ask for Section 5 oversight. But the Section 2 standard is completely distinct, like night and day, from a legal perspective as to what triggers liability. Under Section 5, you can have a hair trigger statistical liability, but that's not what the plaintiffs are pursuing. They're pursuing a totally different area of the law under Section 2, which has a causality requirement. You have to actually show there's harm to minority voters, not just some theoretical statistical harm. I mean, look at the experts that's been called in this case. You actually had an expert saying blacks were less sophisticated, and that's not an expert for North Carolina. That was an expert for the plaintiffs who said that blacks were less sophisticated and they couldn't do rudimentary things such as register to vote. I mean, it's this patronizing attitude that somehow minority voters are incapable of doing the basics that have been done for decades successfully, like registering to vote.
Kareem Creighton, pick it up. Bad facts is the first argument here, the bigger turnout in 2014, so that doesn't hold up. And it's patronizing to say that minority voters can't go through the process like any other voter.
Well, let's take the points in reverse order. As far as the question about who's best able to exercise their rights in the political system, I think it's fair to say that the selectivity and it's very carefully crafted of this legislation does not apply to everyone equally. Some people get fast-tracked. Other people have to go through the administrative process.
What do you mean by that?
Sure. With respect to the access, the first example, which is no longer at the center of the case, voter ID rules, the legislature gave basically instant access to anybody who held a driver's license and forced, by contrast, people who didn't have a driver's license to go through an administrative process. Okay. We know that there's a racial difference with respect to people who have driver's licenses and those who don't. A second example, though, that is still part of the case, these precinct changes. I mentioned earlier that the Republicans did a pretty crafty job at changing the election maps in 2010.
This is redistricting in North Carolina. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And one of the things that they did was actually do a number of split precincts. So the complication you all mentioned in the last segment about people sometimes moving and having more problems voting in the right precinct. And sometimes, in some cases, the precincts themselves change. So the person didn't move and the lines changed around them. And so the place that they would normally go to vote all of a sudden changed. It turns out that in a lot of these places, cases. Race is being argued in another case, was heavily informing how the legislature drew those cases. So there's a racial impact on how people actually have to interact with rules that require them to vote in exactly the same places they did before. As far as the question of empirics, I think this all goes down to the question of how well-crafted the presentation is of the election empirics.
The suggestion that facts of who's coming out to vote.
Who's coming out to vote and whether or not this one election indicates that there's no change at all. First off, nobody would look at one election and say that's definitive proof as to whether the effect is positive or negative. But all of the specifics of this particular election in 2014 show that there were a lot of things done that make this an aberration and not the best measure of how often people cast votes in either the black community or elsewhere. The governor in this case specifically scheduled the special election in Congressional District 12 to happen in November. That seat had been vacated for close to a year, and it's more than, I think, just happenstance that that election was held for basically 11 months until the regular general election. It was done to make sure that African Americans would show up on that day to actually offer the state an argument that minority turnout is up. But, you know, the other question of this is 2010 was an especially low level of turnouts, including African Americans, so it didn't take much to increase participation. But looking at any one election, any social scientist would tell you would be quite folly. But if you look at the way in which this provision, all of these revisions were crafted, there's an argument, a fair strong argument to be made about the intent behind the plan and certainly also about the likely effect. And the question that the plaintiffs are offering to the judge is it possible to suggest from the evidence that it is likelier than not that these people who sponsored the legislation knew what the likely effects would be and did it because they knew what the likely effects would be?
Jay Christian Adams, let's step back for a second here. It's not hard to see, I guess, that if you're low income, it may be more difficult to have the flexibility to vote. I mean, it's not like an attorney who can call his secretary and say, Sally, I'll be in a little late. I'm going to go vote. Why take steps when we heard earlier from the reporter that you don't have a significant or any real problem with fraud in North Carolina? Why take steps to tighten? Why not err on the side of generosity in making the voting easier for people to do?
Well, first of all, I just gave you an example in Pembroke.
Yes, you did. You gave me one example, but that's so, we're not going
to. I mean, we could fill your show up with other examples, but I at least wanted to give you one.
Mm-hmm.
But you talk about generosity. Look, the plaintiffs want to roll back the clock. They want to go back to an old-fashioned way of voting where we saw in the 1800s, where you didn't have the ability to verify who was showing up like a mob at the polls. You didn't have the ability to ensure that they were eligible to participate. That's when what went haywire in Pembroke. And so it's not as if this is some theoretical effort to harm people. This is a in America, we had reforms in the early 1900s with secret ballots, with pre-registration, with precincts. With all of these reforms are enacted, and the plaintiffs want to go backwards, not forward, to a world where pretty much anything goes. Look, I think early voting, it's expensive. It stops observers from observing the election because they can't afford it. You talk about low-income people. I think high-income people have just as much difficulty getting off work. People who work at regular upper middle-class jobs, they can't exactly say, I'm not going to go. I don't think that that cuts any one direction. The plaintiffs are going to have an extremely difficult time here trying to argue to this court when you have the most recent election showing the minorities were simply not affected negatively by these changes.
You mentioned reforms in the early 1900s. Of course, there were also reforms in the 1960s. And that said, hey, we find systematic racial discrimination in voting law. And, I mean, everybody knows about the huge push for the Voting Rights Act. It was famous out of Hollywood this year at the Academy Awards and everything else. What about those reforms? Are those being rolled back? That awareness that there's a history of discrimination that's also very real here that needs acknowledgement.
Well, certainly not. And you can't just make something discrimination by labeling it such. You actually have to have evidence that there was a specific intent to discriminate.
I think that was fairly well settled in the 50s and 60s that was the historical
Absolutely.
Problem.
Absolutely, in the 50s and 60s, and that's why the Voting Rights Act was passed. But you can't just label something as discriminatory without evidence in 2015. You actually have to have statements, for example, by legislators saying things like, you know, this will reduce black turnout or will prevent blacks from voting. That evidence doesn't exist in North Carolina. There's nothing even remotely close to that. And so the plaintiffs are going to have an extremely difficult time. The Supreme Court, I can almost guarantee you, that is not going to be very receptive to the legal theory being advanced by the plaintiffs in North Carolina that a small statistical disparity, which doesn't even exist, by the way, according to the empirical data, but let's say it did, a small statistical disparity is going to trigger liability under the Voting Rights Act. That's just not the law.
Kareem Creighton, what's the argument? If this ends up at the Supreme Court and they tap you to go and argue, how would you argue it?
I've got to, before addressing that question, I'm a social scientist, and I must tell you, there is I don't know the statistics that are being cited here, but we only have one election that gives us some indication of what the effects are, and that's never a sufficient data point, a data set in which to make these sort of broad points. The second point I need to make, though, too, we're talking about history and the rolling back of time. A lot of these reforms were made in the 1990s, and the state made those reforms to make voting more accessible to everyone. This wasn't aimed primarily at any particular racial group, but the thought was that voting should be accessible to every citizen who wants to. These changes in 2014 and since, or excuse me, that preceded the 2014 elections are all intended to roll it back. The state, one of the state leaders has been on the record as saying he doesn't think people should necessarily be entitled to cast a ballot just because they're citizens. I think that's very problematic, and I think that's the underlying intent. Now, what would I take to the Supreme Court? I think the argument is pretty straightforward. I'm not sure what votes are being counted on the other side of this, but I think most people would argue that Justice Kennedy is at the fulcrum of all of these choices. And Justice Kennedy, I think, signed on to the argument in Shelby County, which rolled back Section 5 preclearance authority on the argument that litigation would do the work of ferreting out discrimination. So I don't think that there's anything at all novel about making the argument to the court that there is evidence not just of intent, that's one element of the plaintiff's claim, but that the effects are disparate in the way that makes it more difficult for African Americans and other minority groups to cast ballots than other parts of the population. You make that argument to the court. You show the ways in which the legislature really veered away from typical regulation, didn't have sufficient evidence to show that there were problems. Pembroke was one case that the gentleman just brought up. But I don't think that you could actually bring up much evidence at all showing the widespread instances of fraud that are being claimed on the other side. Frankly, the places where fraud is most likely are at absentee ballot casting or at the aggregation level when people actually count ballots. None of that was addressed by the legislature, and I think it was intentionally avoided because that's not what the purpose of this legislation was about. I think you bring those arguments to the Supreme Court. I think increasingly, and particularly given the political landscape at present, people are more willing now to think about the racial aspects, the atmosphere, frankly, that informs how people think about legislating. And I think,
but in 2013, Chief Justice Roberts said words to the effect, "We're past this now. We don't need this preclearance anymore." A kind of suggestion that this was a concern of history, not present.
Right. I'd like to just finish this point. Chief Justice Roberts, I think, did a pretty a poor job of actually taking a full effect of the empirical case to be made for what politics looks like in Section 5 states, mostly in the South and elsewhere. But the other point is one wonders whether this would be the same statement to be made after instances in Charleston, South Carolina, because I think that gives us some element of where we are racially that maybe the Supreme Court wasn't as clearly focused on in 2013.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about voting rights and North Carolina, a big case being heard there right now on voting restrictions put in place after the U.S. Supreme Court softened the punch of the Voting Rights Act in 2013. Plaintiffs say the restrictions are racial. The state will argue that they are necessary for the integrity, the honesty of the vote. Kareem Creighton joins us today from Los Angeles, but just out of University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And J. Christian Adams with us from Alexandria, Virginia, and the Public Interest Legal Foundation has worked in many states to toughen voter ID laws. We will talk before the hour's out about the clash in Columbia, South Carolina over the weekend between Ku Klux Klan members and sympathizers and black activists in the streets there. J. Christian Adams, I want to come to you. If this ends up at the Supreme Court, and many expect that it may well, how do you see the arguments and opinions shared in Shelby County versus Holder 2 years ago, setting the high court up to look at this case?
Yeah, I think the plaintiffs lose. And Professor Creighton said something very important. He talked about, quote, disparate effects. That if there's disparate effects of a law, of a state election rule, that it could violate federal law. Well, disparate effects isn't the rule. It isn't that isn't what the legal standard is for Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Now, plaintiffs might want to have a disparate impact theory in the Voting Rights Act, but it simply doesn't exist. The courts have always required much, much more. It requires an element of causality, of actual harm that can be demonstrated, not theoretical statistical harm. Look at New York. New York doesn't have early voting. Does that mean that New York can be sued under the Voting Rights Act because right now it doesn't have early voting? Nobody would plausibly suggest that. But you would have to adopt that theory of the Voting Rights Act if you accept the plaintiff's argument.
But New York was never covered by the Voting Rights Act. It was
It most certainly is. It's covered by the same exact law that is being used to sue North Carolina.
But it wasn't one of the named pre-clearance states, I guess my point is there, that the law was crafted for.
But that's totally irrelevant. Section 2 has nationwide coverage, and that's the only law that the plaintiffs are proceeding under. They aren't proceeding under Section 5 because they can't. It's not a cause of action. So New York is covered by the exact same laws as every single state in the country. And so if New York doesn't have early voting, aren't they discriminating against minorities or other New England states that don't have early voting? Aren't they violating the Voting Rights Act if they don't have early voting? Well, that's the theory you have to accept if you accept the plaintiff's view in North Carolina.
Kareem?
A couple things. First, I think Christian probably needs to look back at the statute. The statute explicitly was changed in 1982, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, to allow plaintiffs to pursue a claim either based on intent, which is the constitutional standard, or effect. So where there is an evidence that the opportunities are not as open to minority communities as others, and it is a version of a disparate impact claim, the Supreme Court has endorsed the use of an effects-based test to show a violation under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. We're going to go back to social science. I've heard this argument before about comparing North Carolina to New York. Mm-hmm. It's a rare thing that Southerners will all of a sudden look to the North to say, well, you know, we should be treated just like them. But let's just take the point on its face. Every state is considered different. And in fact, the language of Section 2 focuses on the particular circumstances of a given state to make an assessment as to whether or not discrimination exists in the circumstances of the case. And it is certainly the case that North Carolina, as compared to what it did in previous years in particular, has made the situation of voting much more difficult for African Americans with these changes compared to other groups. And I don't think that's a novel change, and B, I think there's plenty of evidence to at least make the case live in front of the Supreme Court. This will come down, though, to whether or not, again, I think Justice Kennedy and the others on the court view this example as one that really is a genuine effort to regulate the political system, or one that really tries to fence out people that they don't like, and in this case, or people that don't vote for them. You don't have to be a stark, raving, stone-cold racist to be a violator under Section 2. And I think that's the mistake that sometimes people make about this. If you don't make decisions that treat people equally, that have the effect of treating everyone equally, sometimes you're just immune or blind to the bias. This law is encouraging you to think about that. And I think the evidence that the plaintiffs are bringing in this case are going to be persuasive to at least make the court give the court a space to make the decision that there is this kind of bias and therefore should be regulated.
Let me get one more perspective here, if I may. Nate Persily is with us, Senior Research Director of the Presidential Commission on Election Administration, was put together by executive order in March of 2013. 2014 published The American Voting Experience, joins us from Stanford Law School. Nate Persily, thanks for being here. What do you make of this North Carolina case, and how should it be decided? How will it be decided?
Well, I think you've heard the two sides aired here today, and that is the problem is that you have a series of rollbacks of potentially sort of expansive voting laws, so that state of North Carolina made voting easier, and now it's making it more difficult. And the question is, does that rollback, not the mere fact of these laws themselves, does that rollback have a discriminatory effect? And should we just look at the effect on voter turnout, or should we posit whether the effect will be that it's going to be making it more difficult for African Americans in the future to vote? And let me just say, just to try to bridge the gap here a little bit, that one of the challenges is that we don't have all that many cases under this provision of the Voting Rights Act that go to the Supreme Court outside the area of redistricting. And so now what you're going to see in the next year and a half or so are a series of cases going to the Supreme Court asking the question about so-called vote denial lawsuits, regulation of the voting process as opposed to regulation of representation through redistricting, and whether those are going to make minority voting more difficult. In this case, I think that you can't look at this in isolation, and that it is a difficult burden for the plaintiffs to push through. But the real difficulty is, are you going to focus on the likely effect of these laws, which admittedly is what the legal standard is, or are you going to ask, well, what's the justification for these rollbacks? Is it all about anti-fraud and integrity? Can you really point to, for example, preventing 16 and 17-year-olds from getting from registering? Is that really an anti-fraud justification? Is moving the number of voting days from 17 to 10, is that about fraud and integrity? Is it about cost savings? And why is it all of these laws were put into place at the same time, right? So you could sort of, in a spotty way, identify individual interests for each one of these rollbacks, but this was quite a comprehensive package.
2 years after the court's ruling in Shelby County versus Holder, where do you see the country headed in terms of voting rights and access, Nate, in a good direction or bad?
Well, I mean, there's a fight going on, and it's a partisan fight, right? And in areas where Democrats are in control, they're trying to expand voting opportunities in general. And in areas where Republicans are in control, they're more concerned about integrity and preventing vote fraud. Now, that one thing, let me highlight something that Christian Adams said. It is still the case that, for example, early voting opportunities in many Republican states, particularly in the South, are actually more expansive than in the Northeast. And so it's not uniformly true. But the trends, the directions that these different states are going are pretty consistent, and it depends on which party's in control.
We will be watching this case in North Carolina and grateful to all three of you for helping us understand it a little better. J. Christian Adams in Alexandria, Virginia, at Public Interest Legal Foundation, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Kareem Creighton, lately of University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, joining us today from L.A. Kareem, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Nate Persily at Stanford Law School. Thanks as always, Nate.
Thank you.
In a moment, a clash between the KKK and black activists over the weekend in South Carolina. This is On Point. Columbia, South Carolina, was in the spotlight again this weekend. On Saturday, there were separate rallies at the statehouse by the Ku Klux Klan and black activists. The Klan was protesting the removal of the Confederate flag from the statehouse grounds there. The crowd of 2,000 was mostly peaceful, but there were some ugly clashes, exchanges that led to arrests. Here's a little sound of the two groups taunting one another. Hard to discern some of the words, but the sentiments just too clear.
Brought you here. No, you are crazy.
Joining me now from Columbia, South Carolina, is Jamie Self, reporter for the state newspaper. She covered Saturday's rallies. Jamie, thank you very much for being with us. What was the call to action here? How were these two groups called out? For what purpose?
The KKK Klan, or the rally with the KKK and mm-hmm. Confederate flag supporters, and also members of the Black Educators for Justice and the new Black Panther Party, decided to hold rallies at the State House Saturday in reaction to the Confederate flag coming down. And that, of course, was a very quick response to the Charleston AME church shootings that took place on June 17th.
The crowd seemed like a pretty good-sized one. Describe what went on. Were the two groups separate at all times? Were they interacting? Were they shoving?
The rallies started on the north side of the State House, which is actually where the Confederate flag was flying until July 10th when it was removed. And the crowd kind of trickled in. There were a few people who carried Confederate flags through the rally that started with the Black Panther group and the Black Educators for Justice. And the speakers encouraged the crowd to kind of ignore them and to focus on what the speakers were saying. And that started about noon and went to about 4 when the KKK rally started on the south side of the State House. So the rallies were separate, but when you walked around the other side of the State House, there was a much larger police presence. The KKK rally was barricaded by fences and police officers. Demonstrators were asked to stay in the center there on the State House steps, and there was much more agitation and hostility, people yelling at each other, you know, over the barricades. So that was kind of the mood. It was very different on the south side of the steps.
We read about some pretty tough interaction here with crowds chasing down some of the KKK members as they dispersed, finally going after them around the parking lot there.
Right. The police came in. They filed into the area where the KKK and flag supporters were demonstrating, and they sort of created this man-made tunnel through the crowd so they could escort the Klan demonstrators off of the State House grounds. And what happened at that point was the crowd just started moving very quickly toward Pendleton Street and sort of followed the Klan demonstrators a couple blocks away down to a garage where they were parked. And there were police who sort of lined the entrances and the exits of the garage in order to keep the crowd from going inside the garage. And then they brought in law enforcement vehicles and gave the Klan demonstrators an exit.
Jamie, I think for a lot of people, both the Black Panther or New Black Panther Party and talk of the KKK can sound like historic throwbacks. Update us on these groups now. First, the KKK. How often does it show up in public like this? How active is the Ku Klux Klan today in the Columbia area, in South Carolina?
The Klan, it's hard to say how active they really are. I was talking with a gentleman at the Black Panther rally who said that last week he was in Easley and there was a Klan gathering, and he was an African-American man, and he said he kind of looked across the street and was curious, and they invited him over, and he went over and talked to them. So I think you have these smaller groups that are organizing. But the last time a Klan group marched on the State House was in 1988, which was a while ago. There was a Grand Dragon who lived in Lexington, which is right here in the Midlands, very close to the State House. And that organization was thought to be the largest Klan organization in South Carolina, but it was involved in some lawsuits in the 90s tied to some church burnings, and it basically destroyed the Klan, according to, you know, experts who follow them. The group that came to the State House on Saturday, and this is notable, I think, came from North Carolina. The organizers were from North Carolina, and with the Black Educators for Justice and the Panther group, they were from Florida, or the main organizer was from Florida. There were some folks from Dallas who were speaking, some folks from New York who came down. So there's very much a presence at the State House on Saturday that was, you know, from groups that came from outside of South Carolina to talk about race and justice and to kind of use what's happened here over the last 3 weeks to get a spotlight for for their ideas.
What about the citizens, Jamie, of Columbia, South Carolina? I mean, this is where the action's taken place. People can always come from anywhere, of course. But what does Saturday's event say about the likely aftermath of the bringing down of the Confederate flag there and community relations in Columbia?
Well, I think any, you know, I think when you have, I guess, groups that are so volatile, you know, you sort of expect what happened Saturday. But the tone of the debate in the aftermath of the AME church shootings has been very different in South Carolina and among South Carolina leaders. The families of the victims showed incredible forgiveness and love to the alleged shooter. Lawmakers who were then faced with the question of whether to bring the Confederate flag down, which has long been a divisive symbol in our state, they continually went back to that moment, looking at the families, thinking about the grace and the love that they showed the alleged shooter. And that has really driven the debate, I believe, to so quickly take down the flag, which, you know, in 2000, there was a very bitter dispute here that resulted in just bringing it down from the State House dome to the State House grounds, and in a sort of compromise that some people were happy with it and some people really weren't, because it sort of put it in a more visible spot on the State House grounds, some critics said. So it took a lot just to get it down onto the ground, still in a very public place. Kind of remarkable that it took, you know, less than a month to remove it from the public view.
And is it up in the museum yet, or is that still to come?
It's been transported to the museum, and plans on how to display it are in the works, and the legislature, I'm sure, will be very concerned with that when they return in January.
The KKK and the New Black Panther Party there at the Columbia, South Carolina, at the South Carolina State House on the weekend in 2015. Jamie Self covered it for The State, the newspaper there in Columbia. Jamie, thank you very much for sharing your reporting on it with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.